Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to what if you commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, eats and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Part 2.
I'm Greg Wyshynski of ESPN, home of NHL Quest for the Cup, where you hear coaches use naughty language in the locker room.
I'm Ryan Lambert from listening to coaches use naughty language in the locker room, I guess.
I'm Sean McIndoe. I'm Canadian. I've never heard any naughty language.
You wouldn't even know it if you heard it. And you're in puck soup. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a Stanley Cup final. It is the Dallas Stars against the Tampa Bay Lightning for the right to lift the Stanley Cup inside of an empty building in Edmonton. And I guess, well, it is really. I mean, when you think about it, I guess we should start with the fact that the Lightning defeated the Islanders in overtime. It was the third straight series in which the Lightning won the elimination game in overtime, which is really fucking wild. Almost makes it seem like it's a team of destiny. But they defeated an Islanders team that in the last two games of this series, Ryan, had perfected a bit of anti-hockey. Darkseid had the anti-life equation in DC Comics, where if you had the anti-life equation, you could wipe out all life in the universe.
Let me stop you right there. I don't.
Well, he did. He did. And I have to think that what the Islanders had perfected in these last two games was, in fact, the anti-hockey equation. It was the death of hockey, the way that they were playing in these last two games.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody watched those games and was like on the edge of their seat until maybe overtime. But even then, you know, there wasn't a lot going on outside of the various power plays the refs were forced to call. You know, and that's also true for the Dallas Vegas series. Like that's my one kind of big takeaway from these last few games is like, Jesus Christ, they have just put the whistles away and they refuse to call anything that wasn't a puck over the glass or like a guy bleeding from a high stick or, you know, where they just totally can open a guy on a trip. Like those are like, unless it was insanely obvious, they were just never going to call anything. So
gotta let the boys play. Gotta let them play. You gotta let the boys play. Sean, Sean, I imagine like me, this is just me projecting for a moment. It would have been a kick to see the Islanders back in the Stanley Cup final for the first time since the first Reagan administration. Like it would have been, they're a team that hasn't been there. So yeah. There's a certain excitement in that. And Barry Trotz, you want good things for Barry Trotz. However, being that it's Dallas on the other side of the equation, I have to imagine that the entertainment value of that final would not have been paramount if the Islanders had made the Stanley Cup final.
Yeah, I think all of that's fair. The Islanders have not been this deep in 27 years. As a Leafs fan, I have a certain soft spot in my heart for fan bases that go through long periods like that. And I mean, it's not like even the Islanders spent 27 years being okay. They were terrible, and you know the arena problems and the uniforms and Mike Milbury and all of this stuff. So I was happy to see them go deep. I would have been happy to see them go further, win a Stanley Cup. That would have been cool. That said, yeah, Islanders Dallas in the final would have potentially been awful hockey
rough
to watch. I mean, that's it. Maybe not. I've seen enough hockey to know that when everyone agrees something's going to happen, then the opposite always happens. So maybe it would have been 6-5 every night and we would have loved it. But I think we said, I can't remember if we said it on the show or if it was, if we just kind of said it to each other, but at the start of the conference final, I said I could handle Islanders, Golden Knights, and I could handle Tampa, Dallas as the offense versus defense matchups. Just anything but Dallas against the Islanders, because I'm very aware that there is such a thing as an entertaining 2-1 game. I'm very aware that Islander fans are going to be perfectly happy with anything that their team does to win, and that's how any fan base should be. Sometimes defense is fun to watch. Those last two games sucked. Like, those were really, really bad. Yes, they were overtime, yeah. And playoff overtime is great. But if you had a friend or like a new fan or somebody who was just new to this, and you sat them down and they were like, show me this sport that you love so much, and you showed them one of those games, they would never watch hockey again, ever. So we may have dodged a bit of a bullet. I feel badly for the Islanders and their fans, but man, that would have been rough going in a final.
It would have, which is, you know, I mean, but that's the style that they had to play, and apparently, and you know, I think the interesting thing is that you could say that Dallas did some of the same things in the Vegas series.
Oh yeah, you could say that.
Yeah, but no shit. But I would say this though, Ryan, that like what the Islanders lack in their version of this are, you know, Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin and Alex Radulov and Joe Pavelski and Dennis Gurianov and Miro Heiskanen and John Klingberg. Like, I think at the end of the day, the Dallas team might actually be a little bit closer spiritually to the 95 Devils, in the sense that like they can play life sucking hockey, but yeah, they also have high end guys that can finish.
In this metaphor, the Stars are the 95 Devils and the Islanders are the 96 Panthers.
Yes. Yeah, right. No, that's exactly true. Like the Stars are like your Claude Lemieux, Stefan Richey, Neil Broughton kind of team, and then the Islanders are a bunch of Scott Mellenbees and Bill Lindsays.
Yeah, like, and like, you know, the Islanders do have some very talented players in the lineup, obviously. Like, you know, I think if you said, oh, you know, they have Matt Barzal, they have Jordan Eberle, they have Anders Lee, they have Brock Nelson, you go, oh yeah, those guys are all good players, and Anthony Beauvillier kind of really stepped up in the postseason, and we started to see more of what Pellick and Pulock can do on the blue line and stuff like that. But just like the Stars, you would say the Stars are one or two guys deeper at both offense and defense, but yeah, at the same time, like, they still kind of, the bottom of both of their lineups just isn't there, you know?
Yeah.
And again, so which makes it just more credit to both teams for getting this far. I mean,
yeah, for,
you know,
sure.
The Islanders give it you. We just saw their season end, but I mean, Barry Trotz is a genius, and he got that team to buy into exactly the right style, and all 20 guys bought in. And we could go down a long list of teams in the NHL that think they have an identity and think they have a style, but they don't have everyone bought in, or it's not the right style, or it's not the right identity, and they haven't earned it. And the Islanders did all those things, and they, you know, I know that to some extent that maybe some Islanders fans would push back if I said that the team overachieved, because that feels like a backhanded compliment, like you're saying that they you know,
well, of
they're,
course
they're
they overachieved,
enough, but they did overachieve.
Exactly. Ryan will say it.
Yeah. So,
but like, I mean, that's true of Dallas as well. Nobody thought Dallas was like, nobody looked at Dallas coming into this and was like, that is definitely the team that is, you know, one of even the three best teams in the Western Conference.
But they didn't overachieve just because a goalie got hot or because of some lucky break. Like, they overachieved by it felt like almost every single night, even the games that they lost, other than maybe the game one blowout, you watch them and you were like,
they were in.
That's as good as the Islanders could play. Like, night in and night out, they were at the top of their game. There's not a lot of teams you can say that for, and so full credit to Barry Trotz first and foremost, but the whole team as well.
Yeah,
can't take anything away from him.
The thing I was going to say too is like, when they lost Game 3, even the Islanders media was like, "Hey, look, what are you going to do?" I mean, Jesus Christ, right? It's the fucking Tampa Bay Lightning. It's the New York Islanders. We all knew how this was going to go,
right?
And then it was like, freaking. a movie where like a guy's hanging on by his fingernails on the edge of a cliff, and that's the Islanders, and Tampa Bay is just like stomping on the fingers, and the guy loses one finger but still holds on the other hand, and then, you know, eventually you just gotta fall. You just – it's right. going to happen. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is, you know, how – if you want to talk about like how repeatable is this for the Islanders, I don't know. Not very probably, but, you know, I guess my point is you don't want to talk yourself into – you know, we were one goal away from forcing a game seven, just like the Senators should have never talked themselves into we were one overtime goal away from going to the Stanley Cup final and that kind of thing. Like, they're, full credit to the Islanders, like I said – but also, like, you know, you need to get back in the lab on this. You're not one or two guys away. You're, like, four or five guys away.
Well, yeah, and the thing with the Islanders that you have to remember is, like, the best player that they're going to add in the offseason is a goalie. Like, I mean, it's you're kind right. of doubling down right now on you know, the style and your strengths as a team. I give Tampa multitudes of credit, like – they were playing against a stranglehold of a team. They looked like they were in quicksand for the majority of Game 6. I mean, their power play looked like it was, you know, it's like running a podcast at half speed, like compared to what the Lightning usually do on their power play. But they found a way to win this game. And just like they found a way to win other games in these playoffs where I think past incarnations of this Lightning team don't quite figure it out in the same way. I was really impressed with them in this series.
Well, they're just a little bit deeper now. You know, the Blake Coleman and Pat Maroon thing, everybody's like, oh, they went out and they added sandpaper and all that. Yeah, that's like kind of what those guys do. But also, like, you know, it meant that they could not play a guy like Carter Verhaeghe, who seems like he's going to be a pretty good player. Like, they don't have to bring him in and have him play even if he's not necessarily ready. You know what I mean? They went out and they got two guys who – and Barclay Goodrow is another one where they got like two or three solid bottom half of the lineup forwards and, you know, obviously having Kevin Shattenkirk as your number three defenseman helps as well. So
yeah, and they get shit done. Like they're players that – I think one of the reasons the Lightning fell apart against the Blue Jackets last year was that they didn't have any self-starters down the lineup. They didn't have any guys like Blake Coleman that could create something out of nothing.
Victor Hedman was hurt.
Victor Hedman was hurt too. But also, like, you know, when they needed a goal, they couldn't get a goal. Like, they didn't have a fucking Pat Maroon just parking his big ass in front of the goalie's face, you know, and scoring those sort of shitty John Tortorella-esque goals that you need to beat a John Tortorella team. Right, so like I think that they trafficked in a different kind of player to add to the lineup, and once again, fucking Julien Brisebois, you know, takes a knee to Lou Lamoriello for GM of the year for some fucking reason. I don't know.
Well, what'd he went out and got Andy Green. You gotta remember.
Well, he got Pageau too. I'm not saying Lou did a bad job. I just think that Brisebois did an exponentially better job. Sean, your thoughts on the Lightning's gutsy performance in this series?
Yeah, they're. They're really good. And you know, we just finished talking about their depth. They've done all this without Steven Stamkos. Like, that's...
It's fucking crazy.
Arguably, their best player, a guy that probably going into the playoffs, we would have said was their second best forward. Maybe now you bump Braden Point up. But, I mean, this is still a first-line guy, and they don't have him... I don't think they'll have him for the final, although I guess we never know. But
he's skating.
He's skating. I mean, this is a team that is really good. And you know, we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. They could go into the final, and who knows what could happen. They could play terribly and open up some of those old wounds.
Or
but this
just
is
be exhausted, like
or just be exhausted. Like, yep.
Yeah.
But still, like this is a case where. And again, it always feels obvious in the moment. And right now it feels obvious that, like, when I sit there and go, oh, the Lightning are really good, it's like, great insight, genius. Of course they're really good. You know, and they're in the final. Yeah, well, we all thought they would be in the final or pretty close. It was, I mean, 1 year ago, right now, like last fall, there were a ton of people who thought that the Lightning were broken. and that they needed something to fix them, some big change. This is, there was just something wasn't there with this team because they lost to the Blue Jackets. And it's a good lesson in, you know what, going out in the playoffs is painful always, and some are more painful than others, but you can't overreact to that. And full credit to Julian Breezeball. He's the new guy. He could have been like, I'm going to put my stamp on the team, and I'm going to fix the team because the old guy that I took over from didn't do it right. He more or less stayed the course, and then when the time was right, doubled down on what he had, and it was the exact right play.
Yeah, it's you know, they were arguably the best regular season team in the history of hockey last year, and mm-hmm. they went out and added guys who made them better. And that's really hard to do. You know, like if you're, oh, you know, how many points did you have in the regular season last year? Oh, it was a million. We had a million points in the regular season. Okay, you're not going to have as many in this year's regular season, but you will be a better team 1 through 20. And you go, well, how's that possible? But right. he did it. Like, that's incredible.
And they added sandpaper and, you know, Pat Maroon, guys like that. But they didn't go in, you know, they weren't out there trading Tyler Johnson for a fourth liner because they needed to. Yeah. Or any, you know, and again, I'm coming at this. A lot of this is what you hear as a Leaf fan, what people want to do. You know, get rid of Nylander and bring in these fourth line gritty heart and soul guys. Yeah, that's one way to do it. Or you can just find those guys in better ways without giving up assets that you need to have the depth to go where you want to go. It's just such an impressive organization, and they've earned it. I mean, they are full credit for everything.
It's also a thing where they made the right calls from a people standpoint. Like when you're feeling the tension of a playoff run, as the Lightning often do, like it's good to have a couple of fucking goofballs in there. Like Pat Maroon is a goofball. And Kevin Shattenkirk is a goofball, but they're also really good hockey players. And in Maroon's case, it's a guy coming in from a situation where he just won. Like, there's a certain amount of calculation on that part of it, too, that I think is really genius level from Breezeball and the Lightning. This matchup's an interesting one in the sense that I feel like the Dallas Stars are the final boss of the side-scrolling journey that the Tampa Bay Lightning have been on. You know, you get past Columbus, your tormentor from the previous season, but also a team that does everything to try to let you not score. And then you get past Boston, which, you know, didn't have Tuukka Rask, but still had incredible defensive bona fides. You get past them, a team that doesn't want you to score at all. And then you play the Islanders, who, as previously mentioned, are playing anti-hockey. And then you figure out ways to score against that team. And now you go against the best defensive team in the West in the final. And I feel like the previous three rounds are going to very much inform what we see from Tampa in this series, which is not to freak the fuck out if you can't do the things that you've been able to do offensively, which I think is what happened to Vegas. Like, Vegas freaked the fuck out, not only at the end of the Vancouver series, but then in the entirety of the Dallas series, and their high-end guys didn't know what the fuck to do. But I think Tampa now intrinsically understands what you need to do against a team like Dallas.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not really a mystery. You know, like nobody was looking at that Vegas series and going, oh, I can't figure out why Vegas is. Well, I mean, everybody knew why Vegas wasn't scoring. They weren't going in the front of the net, right? And to your point earlier, Tampa has those guys, but they don't just have, like, you know, like Brayden Point goes to the front of the net. It doesn't. Right. It doesn't have to be the Pat Maroons of the world. It's everybody. And, you know, if you're just doing a little bit more to create rebounds and that kind of thing, it really can be that fucking simple. So.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess what I'd say is, Greg, you just described why the Lightning are going to be ready for the Stars, and it does sort of make me think of that old quote that everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth.
Sure.
I'm sure that they feel like they're ready for the Stars, but the Stars are really good too, and the Stars are a lot of what the Islanders do well, but with a little bit of extra
talent.
Danger behind
talent.
Them. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I could, you know, I'm sure the Lightning feel very confident going into this, but when you lose game one, 2-0, and then you're halfway through game two and you haven't scored yet, and all of a sudden you're looking around going, uh-oh. this. We didn't come through all of this just to get here.
But that's
it.
I don't think they go anymore. I think they went last year, and I think the last three rounds have prevented the But I also think that Dallas is a team that also doesn't say I think they've got like the utmost confidence that their kung fu is the strongest right now, and I think that makes it a really interesting final.
I don't disagree, and like I think I've made clear I've got all the respect in the world for the Lightning and what they've done this year. I will just point out they've had three rounds. The first two rounds they won in five games. The next round, the round we just saw, they were up 2-0 and 3-1 and finished it in six. They haven't really been pushed. They haven't. I know John Cooper's talked about how adversity has kicked them so many times, and they haven't really had it the way that most teams go through. Like they've haven't trailed a series. They haven't been had their backs against the wall. So let's see. Let's see if it comes to that with Dallas, and I'm not convinced that it will. But let's see what happens.
I disagree. Like I think the only series that was not a push for them was Boston. Like they know what is at stake if they lose that game last night and they win in overtime, and they fucking won a five overtime game in game one against a team that swept them in the previous season, knowing what a loss in that game in that situation would do for that series. I feel like they've been tested. Am I wrong?
It's a test, but there's a difference between being there's a difference between a test and adversity. Five overtime game is a test. Losing a five overtime game is adversity. And I'm not convinced that they've faced as high a level of adversity as they might in this final.
Yeah, but no, I agree with that. I think that they're, they've been tested, but like, there was a five overtime game. I feel like that was maybe 8 or 9 months ago at this point. And it was against a team they are significantly better than, and they won, right? And so, there's a difference between like a test and a test. And I think that, the ease with which they, what was it, five games in the Columbus series, five against the Bruins and six against the Islanders, and even those six games, you were like, it was six games, but it wasn't like a close six games, even though two of them went to overtime. Basically, they came out and they were like, oh yeah, we're the kind of team that can score nine goals against you in a conference final, and it's not a big fucking deal for us. And so, yeah, like I think Dallas in some ways had the harder path to the final, and
sure, played a game seven,
right? But and with obviously that having been said, they also played like a third string goalie for 3 games. So. Yeah.
Oh, that's no way to talk about Cam Talbot, sir. No, first of all, to carbon date that five overtime game. There was a Tom Steyer commercial on right before the fourth overtime, Ryan.
Wow.
I think my counter argument to both of you is that part of the education of the Lightning is to not put themselves in that situation. And I know what you're saying. Like, if you're not in a game seven, or if you're not you're facing elimination, you don't face the same adversity as a team like the Stars did playing in a game seven against Colorado. But I think what makes this Lightning team so impressive is that ability not to lose the five overtime game. Is that ability to not lose game six to the Islanders like they lost game six to the Penguins, like they lost game six to the Capitals in two previous conference finals. Like, that's the maturation of this group. And so while I agree that they've not necessarily faced the same level of adversity as other teams in this playoff, I think it's to their credit that they haven't. I think it's by design that they haven't.
Oh, yeah. No, like, if they had just gone, we swept every team we played so far. We haven't, what are they, like 9-3 in these playoffs? Or 12-3 or whatever it is? I don't, They're unbelievably good. And I think part of the maturation of this team or whatever, you can just kind of go, well, if you give a really good team enough kicks at the can, they're going to come through eventually. And I think that's definitely part of it as well, where it's all like, right, they go to the conference final every other year.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what somebody was, I can't remember where I saw it, but someone was like, look, building a you used to in the NHL be like, we want to build a Stanley Cup team. Now you build a team that's going to be one of the best five in the league for 5 years in a row, and you hope that the odds shake out in your favor. And
yep.
That's what Tampa's been. And it's funny. I remember in 2015 after they lost in the final to Chicago, and they there was that young team, and Kucherov was just starting to establish himself. Stamkos is in his prime. Hedman, all of those, you go down the list. And I remember I wrote a piece where I was like, what teams are going to win Stanley Cups in the next 5 years and what are their odds? And I gave Tampa less than a 50-50 chance, and people flipped out. People were like, how can you say it's less than 50? It's like 80% or 90%. This team's, of course, going to win. And I was like, there's just so many things that go wrong.
The best team in the league has like 25% chance.
I'm like, there's no way. Like the first time when I sat down and did that exercise the first time, I put like my ballpark for all 30 teams, and it added up to like 900%. Like I was giving everybody way too big a chance. And here we are 5 years later. They haven't been back to the final. They even missed the playoffs one of those years, which would have felt amazing.
Yeah, they did.
But there's a good chance they're going to ultimately prove me wrong, but they're going to take the maximum amount of time to do it.
But that just goes to show, right? Like, you looked at this team, and everybody on the planet said, this team is going to win a cup in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
And then, because it's the NHL, one of those years that consensus best team in the league, or, close to it, missed the fucking playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what hockey is. It's so much, what is it, like 40% bounces? it's fucking crazy. And so, yeah, to like
and
go,
injuries
oh, I have
and
a million different things can go right or wrong at any time. And, like that, again, to my earlier point, that's maybe why the Islanders or the Senators or the Stars, teams that kind of come off the radar a little bit and make it to a conference final or even a cup final, you go, oh, that's weird, but I guess it can't be unexpected, right?
This is the closest I think you've ever come in Puck Soup 2.0 history to embracing the beauty and romanticism of playoff hockey. Like
I'm not I think it's stupid. I think the better team should win far more, but it's the stat that I think is Mike Lopez has of like if the better team in the NBA, quote unquote, the better team on paper wins 80% of the time in the NBA, and in like the NFL it would have to be a best of 21 series to produce the same outcomes. In hockey it's a best of 53 or something like that.
Right.
That's how random hockey is. And I think it doesn't lead necessarily to the right kind of decision making, because you can be, again, like the San Jose Sharks a few years ago, and you're like, oh well, we lost four games in a row to the Kings, who were one of the best teams who ended up being one of the best teams of the era, and they were like, oh, we have to fucking trade for 9 fighters because we're too soft. You know what I mean? And like, how many good series were we robbed of because of that kind of decision making?
Yeah, I mean,
I think
the Anaheim
getting smarter.
The Anaheim Ducks brainworms from their cup in 2007, I think, was one of the bigger problems, where like teams like Minnesota all of a sudden started investing in like fighters because Brian Burke built a tough team.
Right. And like, and everybody ignored, oh, they had Scott Niedermeyer and Chris Pronger. The way the Ducks win isn't because they're tough to play against, quote unquote, like, they play heavy hockey. They won because they had the two best defensemen on the planet each playing 32 minutes a night.
Yeah.
It's not a fucking complicated equation here.
It helps. All right. Cup final real quick, prediction type dealy. As I've long said, that the team that wins the cup is usually the team that has the best like storyline for their commemorative, well, in the past, Blu-ray or DVD. I don't know what you would, even if they make them now. But it's always
like
the team.
Yeah, you got your freaking Netflix. You got your Hulu.
Yeah, you'd be streaming it on.
Yep.
There's so many streaming services.
A year in review.
I don't know what to watch.
Yeah, you'd be watching this entire run from the champion in little 3-minute bites on Quibi, for goodness sakes. So anyway, so it's usually the team with the best storyline. You know, the Capitals and Vegas both had a stake of the a claim of it. I think the Capitals, you know, breaking their curse was the better story. Obviously, St. Louis and Gloria and all that shit winning their first cup. Obviously, in the Lightning's case, you have this team that got punched in the mouth last season, this team that's been chasing a cup in this current incarnation, the John Cooper Lightning. And then you also have, you know, the possibility of, you know, Stamkos maybe coming back at some point. Who's to say? He had strong older brother just got back from rehab vibes during the Prince of Wales trophy presentation last night. So who's to say? But they've certainly got some interesting storylines. But what they don't have is they don't have a catchphrase. And the Dallas Stars, the "we're not going home" that we've heard Joel Kiviranta say it and Anton Khudobin say it and Jamie Benn say it, it's a beautiful thing. It's the thing you put on T-shirts. It's the thing that somebody bellows into a microphone 15 years from now at the Stanley Cup Championship reunion in Dallas. You know, it's the kind of thing that – the kind of rallying cry that you remember. And also the fact that they had the Jim Montgomery thing happen and Rick Bowness being old and going to the bubble with the COVID and the whole thing. There's a lot of things about the Dallas Stars that also tell you that they could be the team of destiny.
I have a theory about the "we're not going home" thing.
What's
None
that?
Of them like their families.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good point. It can be read as several ways.
You know, like some of these guys have got wives at home. We've got like five kids crawling all over the place. And they see like husband, "I'm not going home." And they're like, "Yeah, oh, yeah, good. That's great."
Exactly. That all said, Lightning in six. I truly believe that the last three rounds have informed this round. I'm a little bit concerned about fatigue. They looked really bad at times last night. They looked absolutely fucking gassed. And Dallas is going to be on, you know, 5 days of rest and you know, are playing with the utmost of confidence. I do believe that the Lightning are going to find a way. I don't necessarily think Stamkos is coming back, by the way, but I do think the Lightning are going to find a way. I'm a little bit concerned about point. But I don't know. I just feel like that if they're ever going to do it, it's going to be now. And I feel like it's finally going to happen, everybody will leave. After
they
the
are
season.
Beat up though. Like we don't, you know, Braden Point's back, but that doesn't mean he's okay. Anthony Cirelli came back and got the overtime winner.
That was a miracle.
Are we sure he's okay? Because that, I mean, we saw it in previous rounds where guys would, you know, come back. You know, Landeskog. Remember, he came back that game, and then after the game, they were like, "Yeah, he's not playing anymore." This is one of those things.
But at least
where,
you turned the double play on it, you know, on that takeout slide.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. So it's one of those things where it's like we all want the schedule to keep moving. But I bet you this is the one year where Tampa's like, man, we kind of missed that random 6 day gap the NHL would usually drop in right around here for no good reason.
Well, I guess this is my point to bring up. The fact that there's a fucking back-to-back in the Stanley Cup final is insane.
I mean, it is, but like, if these players had their druthers, they'd probably play every day, just to get the fuck
this
out of
it.
There.
They want it Saturday night. They want it both the Saturdays, and the only way to do that is either a back-to-back or you put a three-day gap. And I don't know that there's a big appetite for that
for a three-day gap.
Now. But what was fascinating to me was like, you know, we didn't know what the schedule was going to be, obviously, because we didn't know if there was going to be a game seven on the weekend. But there was all this like back and forth, you know, some of the insiders who have access to this stuff were like, you know, there's going to be a back-to-back. Wait, there's not going to be a back-to-back. And it didn't end up mattering because I feel like for Dallas and Tampa, it's probably, they've both got one starter in goal, assuming Ben Bishop isn't healthy, so it's equally tough for them to have a back-to-back. But what an advantage that would have been for the Islanders to have a back-to-back in a series where they've got two goalies they trust versus, you know, we saw what a disaster it was for Dallas the last time they had to face that. I really wonder if the Islanders had made it, if they would have had to rethink doing a back-to-back just because of how much of a competitive advantage that would seem on the surface to be for one of the teams.
Yeah. True. Ryan, what's your take on the series? Who do you like?
I like Tampa six or seven games, I guess. You know, it's – I just err on the side of there's a team I think is notably better on paper is usually how I make these picks, and I don't see any reason to get away from that now. I think Tampa is, like I said, like 1 through 20. You go, oh, they're dangerous. And with the Stars, it's more like 1 through 14 maybe, and then the rest is like – who? And now, granted, like, I would have said who about Joel Kiviranta a couple of weeks ago, but yeah, I mean, you know, you know everybody on the team, and even if they have to go into their depth a little bit, like I said, like a Carter Verhaeghe, you go, oh, he could play for, you know, middle 6 minutes for three quarters of the teams in the league right now, and he's the 13th forward on the Lightning.
I want to mention something about Kiviranta real quick. This is the only forum on which I can talk about this. There's been at least two occasions. Mark Spector from Sportsnet asks questions in these Zoom calls with the players where the setup is about a minute and a half.
Yeah.
And then there's a question. At least two occasions when asking a question of Kiviranta, the setup has basically been, Joel, you know, back home, I figured no one at all knows who you are. You are like an anonymous figure back home. Like, you are somebody who did not even exist in the minds of the people back home before these playoffs. They don't even know who you were or that you were born there. Or, and I'm just like, okay, we get it. We get it. We get it. It was just, and every time he asks it, like, Jamie Benn just starts rolling the eyes back into the back of his fucking skull during these setups from Spector on these fucking questions, Kiviranta. It's just twice it's happened now. I'm just like, all right, buddy, we get it. You don't need a fucking preamble. Just ask the question. Now,
Joel,
Sean,
you would agree that you were a loser before this, right? Nobody knew you were.
It is essentially that.
Yeah.
It is essentially that. It's
right.
Essentially like, you know, it's like, you know, we all know that your ratings on NHL 20, you were a minus 40 in skill. They just thought you were just a piece of shit. What's that like to now not be one? Sean, I smell something in the air when it comes to your prediction for this series, and it smells like Pecan Lodge and Scheinerbach. Are you picking Dallas?
I'm not. No, I filed my pick on our like group predictions. I picked the Lightning, and I picked the Lightning in five. I just think they're better. I certainly wouldn't be shocked if the Stars won. I mean, this isn't. It would be an upset, but it would not be a surprise by any stretch. But I think Tampa is just better. I could see them winning a five-game series where all four wins are one-goal games, but I think it's I think they're the better team. I don't think we're going long. I know Tampa certainly hopes we're not going long, my pick was Tampa in five.
There you go. So it should be an entertaining final. I think it could be physical. I think there's some big personalities in it. And there's some cool storylines too. I mean, like the fact that Rick Bowness was sort of the assistant coach that helped John Cooper become an NHL coach in some ways, according to Coop, is an interesting
story. And did you see that the NHL tweeted out, this is the first time in history that the Stanley Cup final is two coaches where one of them was the other guy's assistant somewhere?
That's wild.
Blew my mind. Like, how could – considering like it's the same 50 coaches cycling through all these jobs, it's amazing to me that has never happened before. But
yeah, especially like
crazy.
Based on, you know, there used to be six fucking teams in the league.
Yeah.
You know, like, would think, but
yeah.
Here we are.
Just based on the percentages. I mean,
Yeah, they didn't really have assistants back then. You didn't need like
That's true, guys.
Running every piece of your bench. But I mean, now that every team has three coaches whose job is to just watch replays for offsides, that stat probably won't last very long, but for now.
You know how I learned about they're not when assistant coaches became a thing? Real quick, I don't even know if I've ever told the story on the show, but one day, director Kevin Smith reached out to me. This is back in the Puck Daddy days. And it was when he was going to write this hockey movie, Hit Somebody. And he reached out to me, and he's like, man, I got a bunch of questions to ask you. You around? I'm like, sure. And so Kevin Smith calls me up, and he's obviously baked, you know, being that he's Kevin Smith. And we talk for like 45 minutes just about random shit. And then this is like a thrill for me because, I mean, I'm a kid from Jersey and like I went to the premiere of Clerks and shit, and it was great. But like one of the things was he's like, I'm writing this movie in the 1970s. I got to know something. Were there assistant coaches back then? I'm just like, it was the most like random fucking question. But it made me go and research the history of assistant coaches. And it was fascinating to find a time in which there wasn't assistant coaches in the NHL. I mean, being that it's so like – now there's like a coach for every facet of the game on the bench and in the press box. Mm-hmm. There you go. A stoned Kevin Smith made me realize the history of assistant coaches in the NHL.
That's a great story. Can I also just send one quick shout, just because I mentioned offside reviews. God bless the Islanders and Lightning for giving us an actual, for the first time in 5 years, an offside review of an obvious offside. Like the Matt Duchene play finally happened again. For the first that we put this rule in because we couldn't have the Matt Duchene thing. We took hundreds of legitimate goals off the board, but we finally caught one. We got them, boys. Wrap it up.
Speaking of which, probably they're not going to let the puck over the glass thing.
Yeah, we should mention that. Like, so yeah. That it happened a bunch of times in the Islanders series. Obviously, the Dallas series ended on the Zach Whitecloud play, which honestly. Even if you gave the referees discretion, I still think that's a penalty on Whitecloud given the situation and given what he did on the play. Like, I know it wasn't intentional, but, like, there's also, like, times when you trip somebody and it's not intentional, but, like, you're just trying to defend them as best you can.
And if it happens in overtime, it doesn't...
doesn't get called.
It doesn't get called, so...
Yeah, right. Correct. Right. But, like, what do you think happens with puck over the glass? I tend to believe they won't do anything with it, that they'll just keep the rule. But I'm sure there's going to be a little bit of a push to get it changed after this playoff.
Yeah, I think it'll be more at the referee's discretion. Like just the fact that it's automatic is very weird. And you know, obviously, it's been this way for a million years at this point. But you know, I think that like just the college hockey rule of, you know, if you put the puck over the clean over the glass, you don't get a change and the faceoff is in your end. Like it's an icing.
Yeah.
And I think that's fine.
I've said a million times how I would do it. I would treat it like icing. In fact, I wouldn't even say if it's over the glass clean, I just say you shoot the puck out. We don't have to argue over whether it ticked off the glass or whether it went over a certain part of the bench. If you shoot the puck out or you shoot the puck down the ice, we treat it exactly the same. We do a face-off. You don't get to change. If you're worried that players are going to intentionally shoot it out, which people swear used to happen, I have no recollection of it. I've spent most of my life complaining about things that happen in NHL games. I don't remember ever being mad about somebody intentionally shooting a puck over the glass. But if you think that's going to happen, let the referee have the discretion to call obvious intentional ones. That's how we handle every other delay of game. In one of the, I don't remember which one it was, but one of the puck over glass, like 2 minutes later in the same game, somebody pushed a net off.
Yeah.
And that's delay of game, or it could be, but it doesn't have to be. You know, we don't say if the net comes off and the defensive team touched the net that it's an automatic penalty no matter what. We let the referee say, yeah, look, if they did it on purpose, call it, and if not, don't call it. So that's what the NHL should do. I'm not convinced that they change it because even though we've seen it end a series, we'd seen that before too. I mean, the very first year we had it with Carolina and Buffalo, it decided a series in a game seven. We didn't learn anything new about this rule. All the objections that people have had over the last few days, we already knew. The GMs already knew.
The league always needs that little extra push, it seems like. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, but it needs to be a big push. Like skating the crease, we knew that rule sucked for 5 years, and it had to happen in the Stanley Cup final in overtime. So I don't know if this is enough of a push.
You don't have to go that far back. I mean, the shit that happened in the St. Louis run last year and the shit that happened in the Sharks-Vegas game last year necessitated rule changes after that, in that playoff.
So maybe it happens. It's the sort of thing where, like, if we didn't have this rule and somebody suggested it, nobody would be like, yeah, we need to do that. That's a good idea. We wouldn't, especially after seeing what we just saw. But there's that bias towards sticking with what you have. And right now we have the rule. I would be pleasantly surprised if they actually fix this, even given everything that's gone on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I do remember early on when they talked about this rule, there was going to be more discretion from the referees. And honestly, like, if you want to throw that bad boy into the, let's look it over on the iPad protocol, just to make sure that they know what happened on the play, who gives a shit? Go ahead. I don't know.
But if the rule is written for there to be no discretion, and the people that like it always tell me that that's what they like about it. It's black and white. You have to call it every time. And yeah, maybe more rules in the rule book should have, we made a joke about it, they don't call anything in overtime. I get that a lot of people don't like that, but that's how 95% of the penalties in the rule book work. And then you've got this weird subsection that is really only this rule. Because even too many men, which is supposed to be black and white, and there's not, like, they could, we've seen them let that go. You know, we've seen them.
Depending on how close they are to the bench.
Depending on how close, or, you know, it can be missed and that sort of thing. This is the one rule, and it's like.
Well, that and blood. If there's.
If they call the high stick.
Right.
Which even half the time, and you guys probably didn't see it, but it was very strange because on a Hockey Night in Canada, they had people like Brian Burke was like, that shouldn't have been a high sticking penalty. I would have let that go. And you're like. Ah, oh, dude, the guy like pretty much ate a hockey stick. I feel like that's probably
and the rule now intended. Actually says blood
like, for the first time. That's one of those things. People thought it was always blood equals. It was originally 5 minutes, and then it became 4 minutes, and everybody was like, "Yeah, that's what the rule book says." And it didn't, except that they changed it last year when they slipped in the replay review for those penalties. They for the first time slipped in a mention of blood as being automatic. So it was. An automatic penalty last night, but it wouldn't have been a year ago.
And that's why guys should just fucking blade. You know,
that's
just
right.
Tuck your little Ric Flair special into your glove, and just when you're down on the ice, slip, slip, snip, snip,
and half. 4 minutes.
I'm picturing you've won your fourth Stanley Cup. What's it all? What's your secret? And it's like some guy whose forehead just looks like one of those 80s wrestlers. Or something.
Looks like Abdul the Butcher.
Yeah. He's like, I guess good luck, I guess. I don't know.
And then you get the behind the scenes on Quest for the Cup where it's an argument between two players. He's like, you bladed. I bled hard way.
Yeah.
No, you bladed.
Yep. Just like back there popping aspirin so that when they get a little cut, it'll gush.
Oh fuck! Mick Foley comes to the training camp to tell him the ins and outs of blading. It's good times. Well, if Dallas is in the Cup final, that means that the Vegas Golden Knights are not, and that was not what was expected when the Western Conference final started. Vegas was your odds-on sportsbook betting favorite in both conferences to play for the Cup, and they are not. So, what the fuck do we make of these poor Golden Knights, Ryan?
You know, this is one of those things where I feel like I'm going to get the, he's just the fucking numbers guy, blah, blah, blah. But I just think if you're Vegas, you chalk it up to, we were like historically unlucky offensively. You know? All the criticisms about, they weren't around the net enough. And yeah, that's certainly true. But I don't feel like that's like they didn't have the personnel to be around the net. They just weren't around the net. And maybe you say like you got to give Dallas credit for kind of keeping them away from the net a little bit, certainly. But, you know, if they don't have follow up chances and rebounds and all that kind of stuff, you know, that's a problem. And that's a systems thing, I think, more than a personnel thing. So I don't know how much they necessarily need to change. Maybe they want to upgrade one or two positions kind of in their depth more than, the top stuff. But sometimes you just run into a hot goalie and you can't make crazy, hair trigger decisions about that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd largely.
What do you think, Sean? Just the numbers?
That. Yeah, well, I mean, it's not just the numbers, but.
No, it's not just the numbers, but. You can chalk it up to mostly the numbers, like 75% the numbers.
Mm-hmm. It is. I mean, look, sometimes you run into a hot goalie, and I do find like every year in the playoffs, whenever we're doing the predictions or anything like that, we always go, yeah, but whatever team's goalie gets hot is the one that's going to win. Or whenever you're talking about a series, you go, yeah, this team's better. But if the other team's goalie stands on his head, that's it. Then they're going to win. And yet when it happens, and I'm not saying that was the only reason that the Dallas won, but when we see it happen, suddenly it's like we forget what we said beforehand and we start looking for other answers. And the one thing that would worry me a little bit if I'm the Golden Knights is they dominated the Canucks through the first few games of that series, and then Thatcher Demko showed up and they almost lost that series. So, you know, we ran into a hot goalie for a few games or even a whole series is one thing. When it's stretching back into half of the series before, I don't know. Can you run into a hot goalie for three straight weeks? Well, yeah, actually you can. That's kind of how this works. If I'm the Golden Knights, I don't just hand wave it away and say, yeah, hot goalie, we're great, no changes necessary. But like Ryan said, I don't overreact to this. I don't sit there and say that, hey, because suddenly we couldn't buy a goal for a couple of crucial games. Yeah, it's the playoffs. Yeah, you're supposed to find a way. But sometimes the other team's goalie is just really dialed in, and that's going to make it awfully hard to win a series. And it doesn't change the fact that this is still a real good team.
Yeah, the other thing to say is, like, you know, for Dallas, obviously, like, their best players rose to the occasion, and you know, they, for all the criticisms about you know, they didn't have a ton of offensive depth, like, they just, you know, it's the thing of, if your stars score and you get one other goal per game, you're probably going to be in pretty good shape to win. And if you're a defense first team like Dallas, you know, clearly is, sure, you know, again, but like, you also don't want to be in a situation where you're like, oh yeah, we're giving up like 30 shots a game and we're getting 22.
So I think the numbers thing that I found, because I agree with Sean, like, I, you know, Demko was extraordinary in the Vancouver series. Like, he was your prototypical, it doesn't matter what you do against this guy, hot goalie, and that just happens. Khudobin was real good, but I don't think that they did, as Ryan referenced, nearly enough to score against him. I mean, it took them five games to just plant Alex Tuch's big ass in front of his eyes. Like,
that's but that's a coaching thing.
In game two, right? I completely agree. So, but I do. So you could say it's a coaching thing, and that's a valid criticism. I also think, though, that when it comes to their offense, I mean, remember they were pumping 40 plus shots against Demko in these games. Like, they were fucking rolling Vancouver. And I know that Dallas is a bigger cut above defensively than Vancouver is. That's for fucking sure. But I think you can look at that top six and say, what was the deficiency here? Where not only did we not convert 5-on-5, but like, when we would get a 5-on-3 in the third period of a playoff game, we don't even like pressure them. Like, there's something off about their top six, and I think I know what it is.
Okay,
I think they have a second line center at most as their top line center in William Karlsson. And
I'm not a big Karlsson guy. Like, I think he's good, but I don't think he's
good,
know.
But he's a complimentary good, right? So they have playing first, right, or like second line.
Yeah,
they're throwing Chandler Stephenson between Pacioretty and Stone, and he does a fine job, but I mean, at the end of the day,
it's Chandler Stephenson. Right, exactly.
Right. Paul Stastny's expiration date's passed. So what I'm getting at is, I know there's a lot of talk about Vegas trying to maybe go and dabble on the blue line and bring in like an Alex Pietrangelo or somebody like that. There's been some like talks about that. I think the hole on this team right now is in the middle. And they don't have that guy to create in moments where they need something to be created in a way that, say, like Dallas did.
Right. I think part of it is definitely the thing about the Canadiens' first line. Oh, their first line so dominant, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, right, but like, if you don't have like a ton of shooting talent, you know, like, that doesn't – being dominant doesn't get you necessarily where you need to go deep into the playoffs. But, you know, I think the thing with Karlsson specifically is, well, he scored 41 goals in that first Vegas season, or 45 or whatever the number was. I think it's 41. And that just talked everybody into, well, look at how fucking good William Karlsson is. You know what I mean? And he got a – he didn't get a contract based on that, but he had a solid follow-up season, and he got a contract based on that. And I think, yeah, to your point, he's a solid center, but he –
yeah, he could play for me. Like, he's a real
– yeah, absolutely.
He is a well-above-average defensive player, but, like, should he be rolling him out in key situations in the third period? I mean, yeah, if you don't have anything else.
Yeah,
honestly, like if I was gonna fantasy cast a guy on this team, and figure a way to get him there, and it would probably also help out the team that he was currently on. And I hate to be Bruce Garriock here, but Malkin to the Golden Knights.
Oof.
Right? Like I mean,
that, you're not the sort of guy that you're talking about is not someone you're going to get in free agency.
Oh, absolutely.
So you are talking about a big trade.
I mean, okay. it would obviously cost
Connor McDavid to the Golden Knights.
No, but I mean, like, seriously, if you're the Penguins and you need to fucking change the math on your team, and they are going to be offering you, I mean, the starting this point in the discussion is Cody Glass. Like, I mean, it's obviously just fantasy casting, and it's obviously not something that's going to happen because I think Gino has trade protection if memory serves. Maybe I'm wrong on that, but like, that's what they need. They need that sort of, you know, guy who just brings his own gravity in the middle of that lineup, because their center spot to me is just so lacking.
Yeah. No, I agree. The other thing to say, though, is I could have sworn at the beginning of this bubble we were like, we can't take too many fucking lessons out of this. Right. And
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, like, in much the same way, people are like, oh, you know, well, actually, Dallas is pretty much set up to keep this going. Like, I've seen that take a few times in the last couple of days. And it's like, I mean, maybe, you know, they have good players, but we had to see Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin go like uncharacteristically good based on what we've seen the last 2 years in this series, you know. Mm-hmm. And in September, in a bubble, after they played a team that was on its third string goalie. And, you know, like, again, just like the number of asterisks you can affix to literally everything that happens here. Like, that's the other reason I wouldn't want to be, like, making any kind of panic decisions. Like, yeah, you're right that Vegas probably does want to add a bigger offensive weapon. I think that is probably their biggest need. But also, you know, historically speaking, like, that, you know, they're going to be fine. Even if they don't make a single change based on what we've seen the last couple of years with this group, I don't think they have too much to worry about. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Outside of the Pacific Gazette right now.
Exactly. Yeah.
Outside of the diminishing returns of Pete DeBoer, they've got nothing to worry about.
That definitely is the problem. And the other thing to say, by the way, speaking of Cody Glass, isn't Cody Glass a center? Like, don't they think he can be that guy maybe a year or two down the line?
I actually asked McCrimmon about that, and I acknowledge the fact that usually the type of center I'm talking about is somebody that you have to draft and not obviously always available. And he mentioned Glass, and he mentioned
did he like better prospect than Split or?
He definitely did not like it better than Split.
Okay.
Split, he said, was a departure from the norm, but that's only because you didn't realize until the very end that it was part of a trilogy.
That's right. And that's the magic that M. Night Shyamalan brings to the cinema.
Right.
He always keeps you guessing.
He always does. Like, why did they put him on the last Airbender movie? That was a mystery. So the thing is that they think that Cody Glass could obviously maybe develop into that guy, but there's no guarantees. Look, the thing about the Knights that's fascinating is, for a team that's 3 years old, I'm constantly shocked by how, like, super aggressive they are to try to, like, win. And I know that comes from Bill Foley, and, like, it's both a blessing and a curse, because they're not going to – I mean, you talk about, like, don't overreact to the bubble. Is there any fucking doubt they're going to overreact to the bubble because their owner's like, this is shitty? Like, it's clearly going to happen.
I think the one thing we haven't mentioned is Robin Lehner, right? Like,
right.
what is that? How does that change the math? Because they you know, if that rumored 5x5 deal comes through, well, they can't have two number one goalies on the roster who make a combined like $12.5 million. So
what I heard about that is that I reported it out. A lot of people haven't. I don't know quite sure why, but like, there is an agreement in place that they're going to extend this relationship. Like, that is clear. I did not necessarily feel comfortable quoting the numbers that other places did, and I know that you've taken your axe out to waylay the fourth period on this one, and perhaps rightfully so. But, you know, I got it from a decent source, and I got enough information ancillary to that that I felt comfortable saying that there's a relationship in place, that they're going to extend him. And that was known kind of coming into the bubble. What was interesting from McCrimmon yesterday was he repeated what Lehner said, which is that, you know, we'll only announce something when it's finalized. And to me, finalized means there's a process in place, right, to then get to the point of finality. The other thing that he said that was interesting was, and this was sort of, you know, pushing back on a lot of the conspiracy theories being put out there sometimes from Fleury's own agent, was that Pete DeBoer didn't want a goalie at the deadline. Like, the management of the team said, we need to get somebody behind Fleury and support that position, and DeBoer necessarily wasn't one of them. So the idea that there was this, like, months-long, you know, campaign behind the scenes for someone to come in and supplant Fleury, I mean, McCrimmon kind of pushed back on that. So I thought that was interesting. Look, I agree. Like, you don't want to spend $1 billion in your goaltending position in theory, but if it's a season that starts in late January and it's a compressed schedule sprint, I mean...
Yeah, that's a good point.
Would it be the worst thing to have both those guys?
It wouldn't be the worst unless one of those two goalies has had his agent tweet out an image of him with a sword in his back, because of how the playing time's being divided up. Like,
right.
And yeah, I mean, there is a point where you just go, hey, if there isn't a trade market and we don't want to buy the guy out, maybe he just has to stay and he's just got to be a pro and figure out a way for it to work. But it does get tricky, especially if you're looking for a number one center, if you're eating up that big of a chunk. I mean, it's not like the Canadians can spend $15 million on their goalies, because I don't know if you've heard, they've got too many centers. They're so deep with number one centers. Yeah. But Vegas, yeah, it might be tricky.
Yeah, the other thing to say, of course, is that Vegas has barely enough cap space to add Lehner as it is. So, like, they are going to have to make changes, because that doesn't even count the couple of RFAs they have to re-sign and that kind of stuff. Like, they do need to make changes that move out money. And obviously, like, the logical place to do that is with Fleury. You know what I mean? So,
right.
Like, unless you can find a buyer for Paul Stastny, which I'd be shocked by, or, you know, you can go, Paul, you're kind of past it, right? You want to like not have that last. You want to come up with a knee injury or something that keeps you out.
Stastny's, like, I gotta tell you though, Stastny's in that like latter day Chris Drury kind of place where the production's just never gonna be there, but he does a lot.
No, yeah, it's a situation, a classic situation where, you know, what's his number? Six and a half, something like that. 6'5", where he's maybe like a $3 million player. And the problem is that, like, yeah, he's definitely a useful NHL player, but he's not worth what he's getting paid.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, so interesting times for Vegas. And I tend to agree with you that, like, they're right there. I mean, they just need to kind of figure out a couple things on this team, and I think they should be fine, provided that the law of diminishing Pete DeBoer returns doesn't strike them. We have a trade to announce. Eric Staal to the Buffalo Sabres for Marcus Johansson. You know, one-for-one deals not always come with the discussion, analysis, and drama of this one. This was a real interesting trade this week. What was your thoughts on it, Sean?
Well, I mean, I'll start from what I think is the easier side to figure out. I said this on The Athletic last night. I think that given where the Sabres are at, even putting aside that they need a second line center, the fact that you've got a guy in Eric Staal, a veteran, a guy who's won not just a cup when he was younger, but has, you know, has played Team Canada internationally, a guy with his pedigree, the respect that he has around the league. If you had an opportunity to go get a guy like an Eric Staal for a year in Buffalo, I think it could actually make sense to overpay to make that happen. Like given the talent exchange, like maybe you give up a little bit of talent to get to bring that presence into the room. Instead, they found a way to bring him in while also upgrading the talent of the team.
Yeah, so, it's crazy.
I mean,
fucking weird.
I know Kevin Adams has never been a GM, and he's sitting there. He's got there's three people working in the entire front office right now. Good job by him.
Speaking of one for one, he is a GM right now.
Yeah. So I've made the argument before that I think part of the problem with trading these days is there's too many chefs and too many people you got to consult and talk to. Maybe Kevin Adams is going to prove me right. He's old school. This is back in the day where Cliff Fletcher was like, no, I don't have to talk to anybody. I am the front office. I want to make this trade. I'm going to make it. Maybe Kevin Adams, through no fault of his own, is going to end up being that guy because they're just not going to hire anyone to help him. But hey, one trade in. That was a really good trade for Buffalo. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they saved money. They saved money.
Yeah. They saved money. They get a guy who's a natural center instead of a converted center.
Yep.
They get slower, but they get more productive.
And I don't think of Marcus Johansson as a speed demon anyway. They're slower, but it's not like it's going from 60 to 0. It's going from 60 to 45.
Like on paper.
Or 50 to 45, rather.
On paper, this trade does so many things. Like you said, it bolsters their offense, gives them a legit second line center, saves the money, which will make Kim and Terry happy. And then you have the known quantity of having Adams having actually played with Staal, so they kind of know each other. And then, although they weren't line mates, maybe having Staal there kind of will help Jeff Skinner get his fucking head right a little bit too. I mean, there's every box that you could imagine getting checked here outside of the fact that he's, 35 going on 36. But then you only have to worry about that for a year. So it's a great fucking trade. And then, of course, the other side of the trade is yet another dumb GM trying to make a winger into a center. Come on.
Yeah, they tried it in Buffalo. It didn't work. With this guy.
It's not even this is the first attempt where you can say, no one's ever tried this, but we can make it work.
But the crazy part about it is that Guerin is basing this on what Dean Evason said, who coached Johansson with the Capitals, who tried to make him a center.
And it didn't work.
It didn't work. I just don't understand. I don't understand. I'm baffled by it.
Yeah. The quote that made the rounds right after this trade was Guerin was like, look, if I don't make a trade, the roster's going to stay the same. And it's like, yeah, that's, yeah. You're right. But you can't just make
here's
a
the thing.
Downgrade
do you want
trade.
That is when I first saw that quote, I couldn't believe it, first of all, because this is basically the first known example of a GM saying that he made a trade just for the sake of making a trade, right? Every time any GM gets asked, are you going to do anything? They always go, well, I'm not going to make a trade just for the sake of making a trade. And you're like, yeah, nobody's asking you to do that. Nobody thinks that's a thing. We want you to make a trade to get better and not just to do it. Here's a guy basically saying, I made a trade just to shake it up. But the more I think about it, I certainly don't love the trade from Minnesota's perspective, but I do kind of get where he's coming from. I've had a running joke in my columns for years now that the Minnesota Wild are always right in the middle. They are always, any list you make, any ranking, they will always finish 16th. They're always right around the playoff bubble. They've never drafted high in pretty much in franchise history. They've never had a deep playoff run where they were actually felt like real contenders. They're always the team that's stuck in the middle. So if I take over as a GM, there is part of me going yeah, I do have to shake this up. I do have to change it and get out of the, because the middle's the worst place to be in the NHL. So, I get that. And then he also had a comment further because there was this whole media availability and Michael Russo had all the quotes in his piece where he said that he wants the younger guys to step up leadership wise and that that was, he felt like that was going to be hard to do with Eric Staal in the room. And maybe that makes sense too. I just feel like this is a case of a GM feeling like, I actually need to wake some guys up. Like I need to maybe make a trade that some of these players aren't going to like, just to wake them up and have them understand that, just being right around the playoffs sort of wild card race every year isn't good enough. I don't think this makes them better, but I at least kind of get where the thinking is. And I'm assuming he looked at other options that weren't available to him. And, this is the one he chose.
Yeah. Well, the thing I don't understand about it is, like, obviously I'm going to always be in favor of trading a guy who's fucking 35 years old if you can do it, right? But I don't look at, Marcus Johansson is a classic guy of, like, oh, he's going to be, like, 25, 26, right? No, he's, like, 30. So it's not like they got younger, but, like, it's not like fixing the average age of their forward group or anything like that. Johansson,
but remember he's missed so much time to injury. He's basically 23.
Oh, that's right.
So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah. It's a completely different thing.
But the other thing with him is, because I've seen a lot of takes on this deal that say, well, you know what? He wasn't very good in Buffalo, but it's Buffalo. Buffalo was a train wreck. You got to write. He wasn't that good the year before either, that he split between Jersey and Boston, I think. Like it's been a few years since he's been even a 40 to 50 point guy, let alone
he's an absolutely complimentary player.
He's perfectly good.
When he would be the winger on Backstrom Ovechkin, like he's fine. He's great. He does his job great. But you need to have him as a complement to like two other really good players. He's never going to drive his own line necessarily, and he's just a nice compliment to what you already have there. And for a team that
doesn't have a lot there, like that's the problem.
Like if this team had a center, right, to speak of, then it would be a different equation.
I feel like they did until very recently. Huh? What happened there? Well, and that's the other thing to say, though. Let me put it this way, like. All the people you would think of as being like, oh, don't trade for a 35-year-old guy, the reaction was, what the fuck is Minnesota doing?
Right.
You know, so that tells you plenty about this trade.
Anytime the Buffalo Sabres are universally praised
for winning
a
trade. Yeah, exactly. Right. That's exactly right.
I mean, come on. Yeah. Meanwhile, the other thing I think you wanted to talk about at Lambert was the Jonas Brodin extension, and I guess by proxy – Matt Dumba all being on the trade block to try to get themselves a center.
Yeah, I mean, I this is another one where I just like I don't get it because I think Jonas Brodin is a really good defenseman. I think he is to Bill Guerin's point, he's an elite defenseman in his own zone defensively. However you want to put that, he is an elite shutdown kind of a guy. He is literally replacement level offensively. And part of that can be, you know, how he's used and stuff like that. Like, you know, they're not going to put him on the power play. Fair enough. But I don't look at that kind of a player and say, you know what, this is the kind of a guy that we need to value as like a $6 million player till he's 35 years old. You know, if it was a shorter term, maybe I'd be more understanding of why that number's so high, like the AAV. But I don't understand how he's both a $6 million player and a 7-year player for a contract that doesn't start for another year.
I don't know.
Like I said, I like the player, but why the hurry? You know what I mean? Yeah. Especially because the whole thing of like, oh, we're always like pretty good to mediocre at best, right? Like that's the range they tend to operate in. And the reason I think the important thing to say about like, oh, we, you know, valuing elite defensemen as we do elite forwards is, or elite offensive defensemen is, you know, like guys can contribute a lot more to their offense or a lot more to a team's offense than they can contribute to a team's defense. I think. I think that, having a Nick Chalmerson type is obviously important, but...
Right. Well, I do think that we need to mention, because we haven't, that they are going... I mean, they're going to be a different team because Kaprizov's coming in. And, if you want to believe all the people that say he's got, a Artemi Panarin level of talent, then that kind of moves the needle for the Wild in some ways offensively. But there's just some fundamental and structural issues with that roster that obviously Bill Guerin is there to fix. I guess the other thing I want to mention about Bill Guerin, Paul Fenton gets another gig, man. He's working for my man Bill Zito down in Florida. How about that?
Who knows? You get the Fenton package, him and his his fail son. And yeah, it just goes to show you can never ever fail out of the hockey old boys club. You just can't fucking do it.
But I will say this, and I don't know if this applies to Paul Fenton or not, but there are some guys who come up in front offices and they're sought after in front offices because they're really good at one of the important things that front offices need to do. Maybe it's scouting, maybe it's trade negotiations, maybe it's contracts. They're really good at something. And eventually they're so good that they get hired somewhere to be the GM, and then you find out that they're not
they
good
can't do
at
that.
Other
sure.
things. And right. and a guy like that, it's perfectly reasonable to bring him in and say, can you just come back and just do the thing that you're good at? I don't think someone who fails as a GM has to
I agree.
Cast out. Maybe that's what's going on with Paul Fenn, or maybe it's just another person hiring his buddy the way that most NHL teams seem to do.
I think his bona fides as an assistant GM are pretty solid. But to your point, I was talking to an executive the other day in the NHL, and they said we were talking about that very thing of the classic sort of NFL offensive coordinator becomes the head coach, and then you realize he doesn't have the people skills that are commiserate for being a head coach kind of deal that always happens in the NFL. In the NHL, that's the general manager spot where you always see it.
Yeah.
You saw it with Paul Fenton. You saw it with Tim Murray. I think that's a good example of a guy who I think is a real smart hockey guy, but has absolutely none of the social skills necessary to be a guy that runs an entire organization.
Jason Botterill, another classic example of a guy. Oh, he's the next great GM. He was actually fucking dog shit at being a GM.
And there's so many facets to that job.
Yeah, of course.
That you get overwhelmed by it. And in Fenton's case, he clearly, by every report, didn't know what to do insofar as running the company, if you will. And I think that he'll be fine in sort of that assistant role. That's why it's really interesting that Zito got the big job after Fenton flamed out. They obviously think that he's got and I do think that he's a more gregarious person than is Fenton or like a Tim Murray. And then you have this Arizona thing where they're going to hire Bill Armstrong from the Blues. And I imagine it's the track record thing is what gets him this job because he basically took over for Kekalainen and then, did really well in that position after Jarmo left. But who the hell even knows if he's got the charismatic chops?
It's all a guessing game with GMs, especially. It's all just this big guessing game of maybe it translates, and more often than not, it seems like it doesn't. So
and the other thing is, who knows with Arizona how many serious candidates there really were? I mean, that is there's only 32 of these jobs. But that's a real tough one right now. I think that's probably the least desirable job out there, just given that they don't have the picks and the situation with who knows how much money they can spend, and Taylor Hall probably about to go. That's a tough one. I wouldn't be surprised if, I'm not saying they didn't get their first choice, but I wouldn't be surprised if maybe there were some options that they would have liked to have considered that weren't available to them.
Speaking of money, the Capitals spent some on a coach. 3 years, close to $15 million for Peter Laviolette. And we've talked about this guy before on the show with regard to the Capitals. Of the three guys that they talked to, I think he's a better coach than Gallant and Babcock. I've always been a big Laviolette fan. Can he turn this team around?
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's a tough call.
I think the biggest problem is that he wasn't the coach after Trotz left, when everybody was 2 years younger.
Yep, absolutely.
The team was a little bit better. I am somebody who believes the window is still there for them to win. I think like in the next 3 years.
I think it depends on the goaltending. It all depends on the goaltending.
So what do you do there? I mean, obviously Samsonov's the guy going forward.
Yeah,
but, like you bring Holtby back.
No, you hope Samsonov's the guy. You can't bring Holtby back. He's fucking gonna want so much money. You can't bring Holtby back. The good news is, from what I understand, it's going to be a lot of fucking goalies available this summer. You can go get anybody you want.
A ton of goalies, yeah.
To me, Laviolette, I said it before. Like, I think there is an absolute revolt in that locker room if Babcock's the coach. I think Laviolette hits that spot where he can be sort of a player's dude like Gallant, but in the end, he's a hard ass. And I think that if you're somebody who believes, and by somebody I mean you're Brian McClellan, believes that it was simply attention to detail and motivation were the issues with this team in the last two seasons, then Laviolette's your guy. Like, it's a real solid guy to bring in. And I pointed this out when I wrote about it, but like, I thought it was real interesting that in Brian McClellan's press conference, he said that Laviolette, it was great that Laviolette was available in our time of need as an organization. And it's not like to take us to the next level, to chase the cup. It was like, we fucking need somebody to come and do the things that this guy does.
Yeah.
And I've never really heard it framed like that, but it's absolutely true in what they're looking for and what he brings.
Yeah, I mean, my thing with Laviolette is I think, like, you know, if you're separating coaches in the league into tiers, like S tier, A tier, B tier, I think he's like kind of right in the middle of that next level down from the top. Like, he's a good coach, but he's not a great coach. Like, he's not going to just, you know, day one turn your team around necessarily. He's going to get a lot out of the guys, but yeah, to your point, like, do the guys have enough to give him anymore? I'm not sure, especially because the last few years, like, the offensive numbers in Nashville were like middling, and like the thing with Washington is I don't know if they have guys who can play a more responsible defensive style. Like, I feel like they have to succeed through offense, and I don't know that all the way lines up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but can we just point out that, like, Washington had like the third or fourth best record in the league last year? Like, they were 2 points behind Tampa and played one fewer game. Like, this is a pretty good team. It's not now. We saw last year with San Jose, you get to a certain age with the roster and the fall isn't necessarily gradual. So I'm not saying that this couldn't go bad, but Washington's still really good. And you know, let alone being obviously just still 2 years removed from a championship. I like this hire a lot. I think this is, assuming that they didn't want to go down the Gerard Gallant road because you didn't want someone who was perceived as a player's coach, I think this is the best option that was available to him. I think it's certainly not guaranteed to work. There's no guarantees, but I like their odds a lot better than if it had been Babcock or if it had been some of the other names that maybe would be out there for other teams.
Yeah, and Darren Drager reports that maybe just Babcock's waiting for his opportunity.
Yeah, I don't know where he got that from. Could have been...
Well, he did not say it was from Babcock. No. He said that Babcock is hunting fish or something along
that. Hunting or fishing or both.
Or both.
Which, shooting fish in a barrel.
Which
literally.
Yeah, and as somebody pointed out when I made the hunting or fishing or both joke, shooting fish in a barrel is winning a gold medal with Team Canada. So.
Oh, shit. Got him. We should mention the Mike Kitchen thing in Florida. TSN reported that
Mike Kicken, is that something?
Oh, there it is. He was let go for kicking a player on the bench in January. Question about the timeline here. Mike Kitchen was still the coach of the Florida Panthers at the pause. He opted out of joining them in the bubble. January 20th, when this was supposed to occur, was just over a month after the NHL quite publicly stated that they would not tolerate abusive coaches and talked about setting up a whistleblower hotline for players to call in order to rat out their abusive coaches and all this other jive. And apparently this man kicked somebody. Dale Talon and Joel Quenneville knew about it, and he remained the coach for a few months after that. So I'm really interested to see how that kind of plays out. Maybe they'll put that into the investigation queue right after this Bill Peters thing they've never really been able to figure out in the Carolina Hurricanes.
And the Dale Talon one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Boy, really great, well-run organization under Dale Talon. You can't say enough good things.
Like, who is the detective they hired to look into this? Is it a fucking dog? Like, is it some sort of dog detective?
It's the internal affairs detectives who were on Vic Mackey for so many years. Just couldn't fucking nail him down. It's like, he's committed hundreds of murders.
It's actually like The Departed. They hired Bill Peters to investigate Bill Peters.
That's right.
It's crazy. Who knew? Fucking, what is happening here?
Here's the big question. Obviously, it's weird that the Panthers didn't do anything, and then he doesn't go in the bubble.
Go in the bubble because, like, he has had like recorded health issues in the past. Yes. I think is
yes, yeah, exactly. That's the reason. But also, you know, the timing of it. It's very strange. I haven't actually seen if his contract was up, and this is like he will not be rejoining.
I think that's what they said. Yeah.
Oh no,
yeah.
No. They announced that when the Fenton thing was announced that he's not going to be back.
No, I know they said he's not going to be back, but like, has he been fired with cause here? Are they getting out of a contract?
Right.
They would not elaborate on that.
Okay. The big question is, did they tell the NHL? About the allegation, right. Was the NHL involved? Because the NHL has made it very clear, at least they made it very clear when the Bill Peters thing happened, that there is zero tolerance for not reporting any allegations to the league. This is not something teams are allowed to just handle on their own anymore.
Correct.
And I gotta say, after what we just saw happen with the Coyotes, with the whole draft combine thing, I would not want to be a team that finds itself on the wrong end of a, you know, if Arizona gets that punishment for violating a relatively obscure rule in a somewhat innocuous way, ooh, I wouldn't want to be the Florida Panthers if they didn't tell the league about this and try to just do it on their own.
Yeah. Maybe not the best place for Bill Zito to be looking on that. But then again, like, the NHL is also famous for, like, if you're not there anymore, then what's really the punishment?
Well, except with Chayka, right? That was their route there, and they didn't,
right? No, that's true, and that's a good point. But I mean, like, in the Peter situation, which again is just so fucking pathetic.
Yeah,
December, and we're not even like publicly disclosing anything. It's insane. He's in the KHL, so like, they probably don't give a shit. And now Talon's no longer a GM, so maybe they don't give a shit. I don't know. I just find it to be I want to give the NHL the benefit of the doubt on a lot of this shit, but like, when it's very simple,
well, they've
to just
earned
be like,
it, right?
Well, I mean, like, I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt when they're going to say they're going to put in the work to make it better, but like, fucking, you know, when you've talked it up in December and we still don't know what Ron Francis's role in the Bill Peters thing was, we still haven't had – Bill Peters hasn't been suspended for the shit that he did.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck are you doing? It's insane. All right. So that covers – oh, Jimmy Montgomery is now an assistant coach in St. Louis. That's a great, great, great,
yeah.
great story. Yeah.
Good for him.
Very happy
and,
for him.
You know, it's obviously – I mean, everything he went through, notwithstanding, it's got to be some – mixed feelings watching his Dallas team go to the final, but he had a hand in that. He had a part of it, and this is, you know, we all hope for a good ending and a continued recovery, but this was that was like just a really nice story to see, because
he's a good dude.
Like, this isn't — he didn't just go away and wait for things to blow over and then come back. Like, he's put the work in to fix the things he can fix, and you know, this isn't a finish line, but this is an important step.
I was gonna say, he had a hand in it in the sense that, like, when Bonus took over, basically he was just still coaching Montgomery's system, and then when they got to the bubble, they had kind of tweaked it a bit, and he put a stamp on it a little bit in the sense that, like, the defenseman got more involved in the offense, and some of the changes that Bonus made have really resulted in the run that they've been on. But like, the fundamental DNA of that team and their system is still what Jim Montgomery did. Yeah, so that's a really good hire.
That team started off like 1-7 and then rolled off like a 17-4 stretch under Jim Montgomery. So it's not, you know, the narrative is going to sort of move the, you know, them heating up over under Rick Bowness, because Rick Bowness is such a great story. And I mean, that's just phenomenal that he gets to do that. But Jim Montgomery got this team turned around and headed in the right direction. So, yeah, good for him. That was
what's really funny about the Stars, by the way, is they had two separate seven-game losing streaks this year. Yeah. And they're in the Stanley Cup fucking final.
I wrote a thing about this, but they started the season 1-7-1, right? So 6 games under 500. You have to go back to before the original six to find a Stanley Cup winner who was ever that bad. Not even last year's Blues, who were last place overall, famously. We all know that. The last year's Blues never got further under 500 than 4 games.
That's
and
bananas.
Dallas was 6 games under at the end of October. And here they are. So it's crazy.
Anyone care about Joel Edmondson? No.
Well, I mean,
the Mark Bergevin apparently.
Yeah,
does.
The joke I made last night is because I tweeted out what is Minnesota doing, and then you know, when that deal got signed, I tweeted out, well, I was going to say, what is Montreal doing? But I know what Montreal's doing. Like, it's Marc Bergevin. And, you know, again, like, this is a classic thing that gets brought up all the time. But it's, you know, oh, well, they have cap space. And it's like, well, I don't think that means you just have to spend it. Like, you don't.
Yeah.
You don't have to spend it certainly on the first fucking guy that comes down the street. Like, you can wait a minute and maybe not overpay for a guy who's like a perfectly fine middle pair defenseman.
And this is basically what I said with the Jake Allen trade that a lot of people liked. I get that you have cap space, and I get that you have spots on your roster. Like, the fact that you have cap space and also budget space, and virtually every other team in the league is either up against the cap or up against an internal budget, that is a reason to wait.
That's yeah, exactly.
To weaponize the cap space, not to just grab the very first guys that you see. And I'm not saying that's what they did. Maybe
let's
they
put it this way:
Jake Allen, but
he wasn't like Edmondson. Again, he's fine, but like he was. Was he one of their four best defensemen on St. Louis when they won the cup? I would say no. Was he one of the four best defensemen on Carolina this year, where they were in a real position to make him look really good? No, he wasn't. So why are you going out and getting, admittedly, like good teams, you know, bottom half of their roster guys for that much money? Like, you can get good teams bottom half of their roster guys for less money than that, and you don't have to give up whatever the pick was and all that shit. Like,
I feel like there will be players, better players than Joel Edmondson, to play the same role at about the same amount of money, that as we get close to free agency, that are already under contract, that you'll be able to get without giving up a pick, and maybe you'll be able to get a pick back just because teams will be so desperate to clear space.
Yep. No, it's crazy.
In free agency, this is a chance. This is the kind of thing where it feels like you sort of have to have the nerve to wait and play a little bit of chicken, because it's possible that you can wait on your goalie and then everybody, the music stops, everybody finds a chair but you, and then, you know, it's Montreal and everyone's screaming for the GM to be gone. But man, I think it's worth it, especially this year being such a weird year with how tight everything's going to be. This was the year to really take advantage of that space and wring all the value you could out of it. And it just feels like they so far have grabbed the first two guys. They still have some space. They're not in terrible shape. But I don't know that they got difference makers, and they've already spent $8 million of their cap space and given up a couple of picks to do it.
Indeed. One last thing before we get to a little overrated, underrated action. The Morning Consult, which is, of course, a polling company here in the U.S., put out a massive sports poll that looked at the race and ethnicity of fans and also their political affiliation. The surprise for me with hockey was not that it's 61% white. We all obviously know that.
I'm surprised it's that low. I'm legitimately surprised by that.
I look back at a report from The Atlantic Which really has kind of must be pissed off at The Athletic for just sort of like, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Sure.
And back in 2012, they reported that like it was over 90%, maybe like upwards of 93% of those who watched hockey on television were white. So you could say that the needle's moved a little bit in the right direction in the last several years.
Or you could say that defining who a fan is a very gray area, and that these surveys just may have used very different definitions of what makes somebody
You took a run at this survey, because the thing about it was like it was like what like they had a favorable opinion of the team.
Yeah, I was joking, because it said like it defined a fan as anyone who said that they have a very favorable view of a team, which first of all, I mean, they could have read you a list of hockey teams, and if you said very favorable to all of them, then you were a quote-unquote fan. My joke was that no real hockey fan has a very favorable view of their own team. I've never met a hockey fan who...
And then my joke was that that's only true until that team's PDO is under 102. Right. And then they're the biggest fans in the world, and if you don't think they're the best team in the league, you're a fucking asshole.
Correct.
So the NHL, according to the survey, 61% white fans. The surprise for me was that is only 1% margin of error time higher than Major League Baseball. I don't know why I thought Major League Baseball was more diverse than that, but I guess
Mondo Chud Sport, huge among nobody should be kneeling for the anthem people. So. Mm-hmm.
And then the other really interesting thing about the on the political side of the survey, the NHL, again, very much sort of like in the same realm of other sports, 33% Republican, 36% Democrat. Baseball is 32% Republican. The NFL is 31% Republican. So it's all kind of in the same realm. But the NHL far outkicks the coverage of the other three major sports in politically independent fans, which I'm trying to still wrap my brain around. Like I thought that was a libertarian streak thing, but people were like,
yes, it absolutely is.
Necessarily. You think so?
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, Bill O'Reilly would always say, oh, I'm not a Republican. I'm independent. And it's like, okay, sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the spin stopped there, Ryan. I mean,
right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look, like it's, if you were going to basically put out a thing that said, oh, by the way, did you know hockey fans were largely white and largely conservative in their views? I'd have gone, yeah, that sounds about right. So, you know, the other thing to say, though, is the numbers of Republican, Independent, and Democrat added up to well over 100. It was like 104 or something in that. So I don't know what that number is based on.
The other thing that made no sense was that they and they admitted this in their write-up of the poll, they were just surveying U.S. adults, which means that they were surveying U.S. adults that are also fans of Canadian teams primarily.
Yeah. And who checked the box or didn't uncheck the box next to
– right.
Because, I don't think they're finding a huge – I don't know what the sample size is that you need to get a useful result out of this, but I'm thinking that the Senator fans in the United States.
Well, the one that's really
senators
amazing.
Senators are much more Canada and the Ukraine. It's there's not.
Well, the amazing one here, based on like you trying to figure out how many people they actually like got that are fans of Canadian teams. According to this survey, the Winnipeg Jets have the same amount of Hispanic fans as a team based in Texas and a team based in Southern California.
No, that makes a lot of sense. It's perfect. definitely good polling. They nailed it. 100%.
Absolutely nailed it. I mean, I couldn't. That was the one that really stuck out to me as being like, all right, maybe we should have just left the Canadian teams out of this one. Perhaps. All right, but insightful as always whenever you get a poll. All right, let's close out with a little overrated, underrated. There were two topics on the table that I thought were interesting, but we could always go off the grid if we wanted to. French fries, which I think has been done at some point, but not recently.
Yeah. I feel like that's
and
true.
And Tarantino films. Have you seen enough Tarantino films, Sean, to be able to do this?
I have, yeah. I think I haven't seen them all, but I feel like I've seen a good chunk of them.
All right. Let's do Tarantino films then. I like it.
And by the way, before we get into this, can I just point out that as part of this, seeing that that was one of the options, I Googled like Quentin Tarantino films just to kind of refresh my memory. And I learned that he was an uncredited writer on the movie It's Pat, the Saturday Night Live spin-off.
Hell yeah.
And that's it's just cool. Like ruined my – I just stared out the window for half an hour and like it just – it's –
He did.
We
he
all
got
to start
script,
somewhere.
He was a script doctor for a while, right?
Yeah.
So he also famously contributed a bunch of stuff to Crimson Tide.
Yes, I'd heard Crimson Tide. I'd heard The Rock. I heard like some other ones. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I guess that he doesn't really lead with that on his LinkedIn page. But
no,
yeah,
not necessarily. We'll just stick. I mean, I think are we just doing movies he directed?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, I'll go first. Overrated for me is Django Unchained. There are things in that movie I absolutely adore, but most of them are in the last half hour.
Yep.
to 40 minutes.
Here's when that movie kicks in is the Rick Ross song. When you hear I Need 100 Dead Black Coffins, that's when you go, okay, this movie's about to get insanely fucking good.
Yeah, and it does.
I really like that movie, but
all the DiCaprio stuff is great. Yep. Like everything when they get to the plantation is great, but everything before it, I couldn't even tell you what happens. Like I just know that movie from that point on, which to me is sort of the. This goes back to our discussion about Rogue One back in the day. Like if you've made a movie where the last third of it is fantastic, but I just couldn't tell you what happens in the previous two-thirds of it, then I can't really tell you that it's a great movie. So I think it's a movie that's really – that obviously has its fans and stuff. It's a great, great flick, as all Tarantino movies basically are. But I do think it's a bit overrated for not being as complete as some of his other films.
I really like that movie, but it could not live up to the perfection of the trailer. Like, do you remember when you first saw the trailer?
The trailer is so
good. You realized what it was and what he was doing, and you're just like, oh, my God. Mm-hmm. This is going to be insanely good, and I thought it was very good.
Again, there are not how do I want to put this? There are Tarantino movies that definitely hit better than others. Like all of them are pretty much at least good, but like some of them I think are a lot of, oh, we've never seen this in this way before, and so that's cool, and we love that. Like, my overrated one is Reservoir Dogs, because it's like, oh, we've never seen, like, all this kind of dialogue and this kind of, like, quick cuts and all these different things. And it's like, I think with Reservoir Dogs in particular, it doesn't really all come together in a way that, you know, again, it's his first film, I get that, but it doesn't come together in a way that all the later ones kind of do for me.
Do you think it became overrated just because of how many knockoffs there were, and it's sort of like, you know, changed in your eyes because of that?
I think the thing I would say is that I probably saw the knockoffs first in a lot of the cases. So like going back to the source material, it's like, oh yeah, I guess this is like the best version of this. You know, but
that can really throw you off too, because a lot of times the knockoffs do improve it. But
yeah, I rewatched it maybe sometime during quarantine, and I was just like, yeah, this is like good, but it's not. I think it's not my least favorite Tarantino movie, but it is not. I don't know. It's a little shaggy for me.
No,
I guess
it's shaggy. It's his first attempt, and in a lot of ways, it's almost like a stage play, right? Like so,
yes.
It's not. Even a movie in some cases, compared to his you know actual cinematic work later on. So I think that's a fair assessment. What about you, Sean?
I think I'm like you guys. I don't have any movies of his that I haven't liked. Of the ones that I've seen, and this is just purely for me, but the two Kill Bill movies, they were I enjoyed them, but they didn't hit on the same level as some of his other stuff is. So if I have to pick an overrated, I'll throw those in there. But they were good. I was going to say they're fine. They were better than fine. They were good, but especially as a like essentially a two part movie, at some point it's like I think I get it. Maybe this doesn't right. need to be like 7 hours of
people. That's getting, funny because
getting their heads cut off by swords.
I would say for me, my underrated was Kill Bill Volume 2. I think Volume 1, because of the bloodshed and because of the insane action, you know, finale in the club, gets put over, and rightfully so. Kill Bill Volume 2 is probably a better movie.
I agree.
Kind of the speaker box to Volume 1's The Love Below, if you will, to put it in Outcast terms.
Well, I also should say I didn't see Kill Bill in either of them in theaters, and I've only ever seen them both at once. So it's hard for me to kind of separate them out, but yeah.
The Volume 2 is the one where she gets buried alive.
I mean, I had to change the DVDs, so I know which one is. But like, I'm just saying, as a pure cinematic experience, I've never like just watched Volume 1 and gone, oh, I wonder what happens next. You know what I mean? So
right. Gotcha. I think Volume 2 has got like a really good David Carradine performance, a really good Michael Madsen performance.
Oh yeah.
I mean, like the whole thing's real solid and just a good movie, a different movie. I mean, Volume 1 is a real popcorn, you know, kung fu flick and supremely entertaining. And then Volume 2 is more of a movie. So I would say it's a little bit underrated because I do think that Volume 1 is the more beloved of the two halves of Kill Bill.
Did I say my underrated yet or no?
No.
Okay.
Not.
I guess I have to say Jackie Brown.
Sure.
But I feel like in recent years it has become more appreciated. Like, I feel like it's definitely the least high profile of his films. Like, it's the one right. where if you said to the average moviegoer, you ever see Jackie Brown? And they'd go, I don't know what that is. And you go, it's a Tarantino movie. And they'd be like, oh, really? Oh, I guess not. It's just like, I think it's the lowest in the pantheon, and it's really fucking good. Like, it's fucking really good. So yeah, what this is really making me want to do is just watch all the Tarantino movies again in order. But
yeah,
hey, end of the season's coming up real fast, so I'm about to have a lot of time on my hands.
What about you, Sean?
I say this as a Tarantino fan. I'm honestly not sure that I've seen an underrated Tarantino movie. I mean, his stuff is so critically acclaimed, and there's probably a few. Like, I've never seen Jackie Brown. So
it's fucking – well, in furtherance of my point, it's fucking really good. Check it out. It would be my recommendation to you.
Like, I'm looking at down the list of, like, the 7 or 8 of his movies that I have seen, and I'm like, are any of these actually underrated? And I just – I gotta pass because I'm just gonna sound ridiculous if I'm sitting here trying to pass off any of these as actually underrated.
Mm-hmm. Favorite? That would be Inglourious Basterds.
Bingo! That's a bingo, right? Remember that's from the end of the movie? Is that how you say?
And
it?
Big hill to climb because I was a huge Pulp Fiction fan for most of my life, and never thought that anything that he did would trump that accomplishment. But Inglourious Basterds certainly did, man. That is a perfectly acted, perfectly constructed, and it gives you a lot of everything. It gives you some chuckles. It gives you some, just an all-time villain in Hans Landa. It's got a little bit of history to it. It's got that incredible tavern scene that just is.
Oh my god!
Just a Hitchcockian level of tension.
Oh my god! That scene.
And I mean Ken Hitchcock, of course, not any other Hitchcock. And I love it. It's great. It's my favorite Tarantino movie. emphatically, and I would say that is probably the same for you then, Ryan, huh?
Yeah, I saw it 3 times in theaters on opening weekend. It was a movie where I saw it, you know, Friday night and was just like so blown away by it. And then, you know, I was telling people like, oh, the new Tarantino movie, you're not going to fucking believe how good it is. And on 2 separate occasions that weekend, my friends were like, fuck, you have me so excited. Can we go see it right now? And I'd be like, I am 100% down to see this movie again. I will say, however, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood might be pretty close to how much I love Inglourious Basterds. It's fucking great.
Yep.
And, you know, like, obviously Inglourious Basterds is the first one that does the thing of – because the whole movie you're watching and you're like, well, there's no way they're going to get away with this plot. So, like, how does it – and then it's like, no, they just fucking iced Hitler, unloaded, like, a full – unloaded a full clip into his fucking face and then suicide bombed that theater. Like – and that was part of the draw. Like, I obviously didn't tell people, like, oh, there's a big twist, you're never going to see it coming. Like, I was just like, you got to see this movie, it's fucking great. And in the theater opening night, the reaction to they just kick open the door to that fucking little opera box and just completely unload their fucking machine guns into Hitler.
Yeah, it's incredible.
The whole audience, you know, packed house, like, one of the greatest cinema experiences I've ever had in my life is just everybody going absolutely apeshit because they were like, well, I figured they wouldn't fucking possibly do it. And then they did it. And then, yeah, they obviously do that with Django Unchained, and they do that in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as well. And I think, yeah, like, you know, I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the ultimate, like, dudes rock movie. And it's, you know, like, it's everything that you want in a Tarantino movie, and it's, I think, a lot more fun than most of the later, like, kind of grim Tarantino. So,
yeah,
that one's right up there. It's a way closer to than I thought would ever be possible based on how much I love Inglourious Basterds, but it rocks. That movie's so good.
Love it.
Yeah,
all right. What do you say, Sean?
Inglourious Basterds is amazing. I seriously thought of putting that as my favorite. Like I said, I'd like Django as well. I'm just going to go Pulp Fiction. I know it's the cliche, but classic. the fact that I was young when I saw it, and like just that movie's just still so much fun, and still, like, I'm not a big movie rewatcher, partly because I don't watch many movies. So I'm like, if I have 2 hours to watch something, why would I watch something I've already seen? Like, Pulp Fiction is an instant rewatch anytime the opportunity presents itself. It's just so much fun.
For sure. Least favorite, that's an easy one for me too. The Hateful Eight. Didn't like it. Didn't really do much for me. Found it to be sort of repellent at times, and it was a fucking sit.
Did you see the full length cinematic director?
Yeah.
Okay. I did too. Yeah. And that's the only time I've ever seen it, so.
And you probably will you revisit it? Because I don't think I will.
I've already decided in my head that when the season ends, I'm going to do a full Tarantino rewatch.
There you go. Full set. That's of his films. That would be my least favorite. Probably not close because the other ones are all like ones I would rewatch. I think it's the distinction between the two. I'm not going to, like, search out to rewatch The Hateful Eight anytime soon.
Yeah, I think my opinion – like, I liked it in theaters, and then my, like, opinion of it dimmed kind of over time. And that, you know, that's fine. That happens. My least favorite is Death Proof because I think it's just the most disposable. And I think that's fine. Like, I don't think anybody would be like – oh, no, Death Proof is my favorite Tarantino. Like, you know, they say that everybody...
I guarantee there's somebody out there.
Well, that's what they say, is like every movie is somebody's favorite movie. I can't imagine, though, that there is more than one guy, and it's probably Kurt Russell, who says, my favorite Tarantino movie is Death Proof. I can't see that. And, like, yeah, it's good. It's, again, the baseline is good, I think... you know, that's the one I've never seen. I saw that once, and I'm never until, you know, the next week, I'm not going to see it again. So,
right. All right. Finally, Sean, what do you say?
Yeah, I never did see that one. I just discovered, this kind of shows you how big a Tarantino, how knowledgeable I am. I just discovered that From Dusk Till Dawn is not actually a Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, he just wrote it.
Movie. So I... Yeah,
would be your least favorite?
That would be my least favorite, because the only other one
that's fine.
even Hateful Eight, I liked a lot. And so much that I played the 100 hour long video game adaptation called Red Dead Redemption. that was fun. No, I liked Hateful Eight, but I saw it once and walked away going, that was a good movie, and didn't really think too much about it after.
There you go. All right. Tarantino movies. I forget who suggested it, but good suggestion. And that's the show for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Check out the Patreon for a bonus episode that I would say is unique in its place in Puck Soup history. And also, obviously, head to the Patreon for our mailbag, in which we answer your questions as well. You can read my stuff on ESPN.com. My column this week is about the New York Islanders as the kings of New York sports by default. Basically. But the Kings, nonetheless, at this point, when we do the show. So there's that. And listen to ESPN and Ice, my other podcast, where this week I talked to former Puck Soup guest, John Taffer.
Wow. Incredible.
Yeah, I know. I know, right?
Yeah, sign up for the Puck Soup Patreon. Greg did a pretty good sell job of it just now. But also, I have a newsletter on there that recently crossed 800 subscribers, which is a nice number. But boy, couldn't it be higher? I feel like it could.
No, 800 is the highest number.
Oh, shit. Okay, well, you know.
Sorry, boss.
But yeah, so sign up for that. And then also, in the next week or two, I'll probably have my monthly bonus episode with Sean Gentile of The Athletic, where we talk about breakfast cereals in Blink 182. So,
You can find me on The Athletic. My favorite piece that I wrote this week was I built an entire roster out of guys who had won the Hart Trophy, and then an entire roster out of guys who hadn't, and tried to figure out which team would win. And it's closer than you think. So if you like your history or just arguing over which guy was better than another guy, check that out. For $1 a month, it's subtle. It's hidden away. You probably haven't heard about it, but there is a $1 a month offer right now. So again, you have to click on my articles to get it. If you click on someone else's, they charge you double.
They charge you double, right? Yeah.
Yeah, but exactly. You definitely go find that.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll see you on the Patreon. Take care. Bye.
See
you.
Bye-bye.
Sticks and hits and goals and saves and slap shots and goons. We've got sportly commentary to what if you commute. But we also cover movies, TV shows, hits and tunes. It's your weekly bowl of hockey and nonsense. Puck Soup.